Okay. Well, so what I want to do today and tomorrow is to start to talk about quantum error correction. So the basic setup, of course, is that we'd like to build a quantum computer or just a quantum communications system, but we can't expect it to be perfect, right? There's going to be errors. And so the idea of a quantum error correcting code is that we'd like to encode the information in some way so that we can correct any errors that occur. So in particular, we have the two usual players, Alice and Bob. Alice wants to send a qubit to Bob. But there's an environment that's causing errors. It's causing some noise. And so the question is, what can they do to prevent this? So, so let me distinguish between quantum error correction, which is to deal with this type of communication setup. And in quantum error correction, we're going to assume that Alice has a perfect quantum computer and Bob has a perfect quantum computer. The only errors are in between. And then fault tolerance, which hopefully I'll have time to say a few words about tomorrow, where you have a quantum computer and the gates that you're doing are not perfect either. There can be errors occurring while you're doing computations. And then you have to do things like worry about errors in the encoding and decoding procedures as well. So in the error correction setup, we don't have to worry about that. Alice can do whatever encoding she wants. Bob can do whatever decoding he wants. And so they'll agree ahead of time that Alice will encode her classically bit or quantumly qubit using some extra bits or qubits and then send those through the channel to Bob. And the communications channel will introduce whatever errors it introduces, and Bob has some decoding procedure that he uses to figure out what's going on. So let's start by thinking about classical error correction. So the simplest classical error correcting code is a repetition code. So we're going to code a 0 as 3 zeros and a 1 as 3 ones. So if Alice wants to send one logical bit, she sends 3 physical bits through this channel. And so suppose we have an error in the transmission. And we see something like 0, 1, 0. Bob receives that. Well, what's he going to do? He's going to say, well, if errors are not very likely, it's more likely it's only one bit that was flipped and that the state was originally 0, 0, 0 than if two bits were flipped, in which case it could have been 1, 1, 1. So more concretely, Bob is maybe assuming an error model where there's a probability p of error per bit. And if that's the case and p is small, then we can say, well, the probability, well, OK, whether p is small or not, the probability of no errors is 1 minus p cubed. The probability of one error is 3p 1 minus p squared. So this is saying that there's one error. So 3 because there's 3 possible places that you could have that one error. P for that probability of that one error, then 1 minus p squared for there not being errors on the other two bits. And the probability of two errors is similarly 3p squared 1 minus p. And the probability of 3 errors is p cubed. So the point is that if Alice just sends one bit unencoded, the probability of having it wrong is p. But if she sends these 3 bits, and then Bob says, OK, it's more likely that there was one error than two errors, if he sees something where they disagree, then if there is only one error, then Bob will get the right answer, right? Or if there's 0 errors. But if there's 2 or 3 errors, Bob will get the wrong answer. Right, if there are 3 errors, Bob would see, say, 1, 1, 1 and not realize that it started out as 0, 0, 0. And if there's 2 errors, you'll see something like, well, you'll see something like 1, 0, 1. and say, oh, it must be the middle bit that's wrong, and go back to 111 when it really started at 000. So these two ones will give him the right answer, and these two ones will give him the wrong answer. But the probability of getting the wrong answer is then O of p squared. So when p is small, that's less than p, the probability of having an error if Alice had just sent one bit without encoding. Okay? So this is what the error correcting code, this repetition code, is buying you. Now, more generally, when we deal with error correcting codes frequently, we don't go through this argument every time. We just say, let's have a code that will correct one error. Okay? And we're just going to assume that there's at most one error. And that if that's the case, we want to get the right answer. And if there's more than that, then we can get the wrong answer. That's okay. Okay? But the logic behind it is basically this. Okay? So that's the classical case. Not all of classical error correcting coding theory, of course, but the simplest case. Okay, so then let's talk about quantum error correcting codes. So let's try to make a quantum error correcting code based on our ideas so far. So you'd say, okay, so I'm going to take a quantum state psi and encode it as three copies of psi. You're laughing. Why are you laughing?
No cloning theorem?
Yeah, the no cloning theorem says you can't do that. Right? So that's a non-starter. We're going to have to find some other way. And if you start to think about it, there's other problems with quantum error correcting codes that we're going to have to deal with somehow. So let's write these down. So QECC stands for quantum error correcting code. So the first problem, obviously, is the no cloning theorem. We're going to have to get around that.
It's encoded in a subspace. The information is going to be encoded in a subspace.
So the next problem is, what do we actually do to correct errors in this classical repetition code? Well, I said Bob should look at this thing and say, oh, the middle bit is different. Right, the middle bit is the one that got flipped. But looking at the qubits, that's a bad idea, right? That is going to destroy superpositions. So we somehow have to avoid doing that. And you know, even if we can deal with these problems, it's clear that quantum error correction is going to have to be more complicated than classical error correction. Why is that? Well, classically, you know, this error was a bit flip error, right? That was all that could happen. But quantumly, there's other possibilities, right? Instead of just a bit flip error, we could also have a phase flip error, right? 0 + 1 could become 0 - 1. That's an error just like a bit flip error. And in quantum mechanics, quantum computing, that would be a problem. So we have to deal with phase errors as well as bit flip errors. And actually, that's not it, right? Because we also have to deal with all sorts of other things that can happen. We have to deal with arbitrary, you know, if it's a single qubit error, there could be arbitrary single qubit unitaries, continuous rotation. There's decoherence, right, that can turn a pure state into a mixed state. And so there's really an infinite set of possible things that could go wrong, even with just a single qubit. And somehow we're going to have to deal with this. Okay. So of course, looking at this list of problems, things look very bad for quantum error correction. But I did tell you I'm going to give two lectures on quantum error correcting codes. So clearly, there must be a solution.
But you gave You're giving a class on quantum.
Yes, in fact, there's a semester class on quantum error correction. So there must be a way around this. But let's start small, okay? Let's start to think about forget these later problems down at the bottom, and just think about a quantum code to correct bit flip errors, right? To protect a qubit from bit flip errors. How can we do that? Well, we have this classical code that protects against bit flip errors. And so what happens if we just apply it to qubits, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to put kets around everything and say we're going to code 0 as 0, 0, 0, 1 as 1, 1, 1. And you see, this is not going to violate the no-cloning theorem. Why? Because if we have alpha 0 plus beta 1, that's going to get encoded as alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1, which is not the same as three copies of alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay, so this would violate no-cloning. This does not. Right, this is perfectly allowed. You can say what happens to the basis states always. That's fine, right? And then what happens to the superpositions of the basis states? That's where the quantum mechanics comes in, and you have to respect linearity. And in particular, what you get in this case is an entangled state when alpha and beta are both non-zero. Okay, so that's the solution to this first problem. Okay, so we are spreading out the information in a certain way, but we're not really repeating it exactly, not the quantum information. Okay, so measurement. How do we actually figure out what these errors are without destroying the superpositions? Well, let's think about this a little bit more, right? So here we saw something like 0, 1, 0. What we wanted to do is we wanted to say, oh, the middle qubit is different from the other two. Okay? But suppose we had a similar situation here, and we had a bit flip error. So we started with alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. And so a bit flip on the middle qubit, so let's say x2, would take us to alpha 0, 1, 0 plus beta 1, 0, 1. Right? So if we have this situation, we would say, yes, the second qubit is 1 and the other two are 0. In this one, we have, say, the second qubit is 0 and the other two are 1. In both cases, so if we just measured to find all three qubits, that would be bad. That would destroy the superposition. But in both of these cases, both branches of the superposition, we see that the middle one is different from the first and third. Right? So if we can measure the fact that this middle one is different, without measuring actually what it is, that's not going to destroy the superposition. Okay? And so in particular, we can break this down into two steps, right? We can say the first two, are they the same or different? Right? And in this case, in this case, where there's no error, they're both the same. In this case, they're different. For both the logical zero and the logical one. And then we can do similarly say, are the second and third the same or different? So how do we encode that as a circuit? Well, we're going to use two Ancilla qubits. And so this is our code word state. And to say whether the first two qubits are same or different, we're going to use two CNOT gates. We're going to do CNOT from the first qubit and the second qubit of the code to the first Ancilla. Okay, and so if they're both 0, neither of these does anything. And if they're both 1, then this bit gets flipped twice. So the output should be 0. On the other hand, if one of them is 1 and one of them is 0, then one of these CNOTs flips this Ancilla, and the output could be 1. Okay, so 0 if first two, well, okay. I won't write it explicitly. So 0 if the first two are the same or different, and 1 if 0 if the first two are the same, and 1 if the first two are different. And similarly, we can do two CNOTs from the second and third qubit the second ancilla qubit, and then measure. And we get a 0 if these two are the same and a 1 if they're different. Okay? So the upshot is that we get two bits here that are called the error syndrome, classical bits. And the error syndrome is going to give us information about whether or not a bit flip has occurred and where it is. Right? Suppose we see the error syndrome 0, 0. What does that mean? That means that the first two are the same and the second and third are the same. So all three are the same and we can say there's no error. Or maybe there were three errors, three bit flip errors. But again, we're ignoring that possibility. Okay? Now, on the other hand, suppose we see 1, 0. What does that mean? That tells us there's been an error. And where is it?
The first two are different, so the first two are different, and the second one's
first bit.
Don't you are the same?
Yeah, it has to be on the first bit, right? Because these two are the same. So if one of them had gotten flipped, they wouldn't be the same anymore. They started out the same. So it's the first one that got changed. And similarly, if you see a 0, 1, you know it's on the third qubit. And with 1, 1, it's on the second qubit. Okay? So looking at this error syndrome tells you where the bit flip error is. And moreover, this information tells us nothing about whether we had the logical 0 or the logical 1. Right? The only thing we learn is where the error is. Okay? So that means that we're not destroying the superposition, and whatever measurement results we get here, we can fix it and still preserve this original superposition. Okay? So that's the second problem solved. So now we have an actual quantum error correcting code in the sense that it protects a qubit, but admittedly only against a single bit flip error. Okay, so are there questions on this so far? Okay, so so let's move on to the third problem, right? We have to deal with phase errors as well as bit flip errors. And so what I want to do is first say, let's not try to deal with both phase flip and bit flip errors. We have a code that corrects bit flip errors. Let's have a code that corrects phase errors. And we can use basically the same idea. So in particular, if we do the Hadamard transform, well, that's a change of basis that switches a 0 to the plus state, 0 plus 1, and 1 to the minus state, 0 minus 1. And in this Hadamard rotated basis, a phase error well, what does a phase error do? It takes 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1, and it takes 0 minus 1 to 0 plus 1. So it acts like the bit flip. Okay? So if we do that same quantum error correcting code, but we do it in the Hadamard rotated basis, instead of correcting a bit flip error, we'll correct a phase error. Okay? So in particular, if we encode 0 as plus 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 and 1 as minus minus minus, then of course alpha 0 plus beta 1 will be alpha plus 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 beta minus minus minus. Then this is a code that corrects one phase error, right? We just have to determine whether the first two qubits are the same or different in the Hadamard rotated basis, or the second and third qubits are the same or different in the Hadamard rotated basis. And you can do that if you want just by using the same circuit, but doing Hadamards all at the beginning first. And then maybe Hadamards afterwards to get you back where you started. Okay? So this is a code that corrects one phase error. Any questions on that? Okay. So so maybe this is progress towards solving the third problem, but maybe it's not. Because, well, if you look at this bit flip correcting code, suppose you have a phase error on it. Well, if you have a phase error on any of the three qubits, we have alpha 000 minus beta 111, which is not something we're going to be able to correct, because that was a valid logical state, right? So we could have had a state that just started that way, and there's no way we can distinguish whether it started that way or whether it's the result of a phase error. And moreover, that's true if you have a phase error on any of the three qubits, which means that, you know, if before we had a probability of p of a phase error on a single qubit, now we have a probability like 3p of having a phase error. Okay, so while we've gained the ability to correct bit flip errors, we've made phase errors worse. And similarly, this code corrects phase errors, but it makes bit flip errors worse. Okay. So in order to solve both of these problems at once, to correct both bit flip and phase errors, we're going to have to add extra qubits. So in particular, we're going to go to the 9-qubit code. The 9-qubit code kind of combines these two things by concatenating them. And in particular, in code 0 as 3 copies of 000 plus 111. And 1 as 3 copies of 000 minus 111. Okay, and of course, the superposition alpha 0 plus beta 1 is alpha times this thing plus beta times this thing. Okay, so now how does this help us? Well, within each set of three, in the valid code words, they're all three qubits are the same in the standard basis. Right? So by doing the same thing as we did with the 3-qubit code, seeing if the first two qubits are the same or different within each set of three, and the second and third are the same or different, we can identify a bit flip error in any of the 9 qubits. Okay. What about phase errors? Well, it's supposed to be that these three phases are all the same, plus, 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 or minus, minus, minus. And if there's a phase error somewhere, then one of these sets of three will have the opposite phase. And so the phases will be different, right? We'll have, say, plus, minus, plus. And so if we can identify that two of the phases are different, then again, we can correct the phase error. I don't want to go into detail about how to do that, but it's a similar but more complicated circuit. Okay? So you can compare if this phase and this phase are the same or different, and whether this phase and this phase are the same or different. Okay? And then by doing that, you identify the phase errors and the bit flip errors, as these two steps. Okay? Moreover, so this is a bit flip errors are x. And phase errors are z. And these two procedures are basically independent, right? We can do one and then the other. You can do them in either order, which means that we can also correct the case if we have a y error, because that's both a bit flip and a phase error. So y, remember, is the Pauli matrix sigma y like this. Okay, so that's good. So we've solved this third problem, and we kind of got an errand for free, right? We designed this code to correct bit flip and phase errors, and we were able to correct the Y errors as well. Okay? So we're definitely making progress here. Any questions so far? Okay. So what about this fourth problem? So now we have, you know, the full set of single qubit errors that can happen. Continuous rotation, secret coherence. And so to go from just correcting, say, bit flip errors to both bit flip and phase errors, we had to increase the number of qubits from 3 to 9. But now we're going to try to correct an infinite set of errors. So does that mean we're going to have to go to infinitely many qubits? Hopefully not. That would be bad. Let's try something that's much simpler and actually really totally naive. What we're going to do is we're going to say we're going to take this 9-qubit code, which we designed to correct bit flip and phase errors, and we're going to go ahead and do the same thing to correct bit flip and phase errors, but we're going to imagine that some other error occurs along the way. So in particular, let's take the error r2 theta. So I want to write it this, I want to use r2 theta because I actually want to write it in a different way where I've taken out a factor of I theta as a global phase. So now we have this. The thing is, this can be written, if you expand it, as cosine theta times identity. I guess it's minus I sine theta. I have written plus. Yeah, I think it's minus I sine theta times z. Okay, so why did I want to do that? Well, what I want to do, remember, is analyze what happens to this 9-qubit code if we have this error on it. So suppose we have this r2 theta error on the jth qubit applied to some code word psi of the 9-qubit code. Well, we can write this way. I'm going to just ignore this global phase. So we have cosine theta identity times psi minus I sine theta z on the jth qubit on psi. And that's just applying linearity. Okay? So now this is just the state that we have after the error. So now let's start to do error correction on it. Remember, we're going to do error correction just pretending that it was an x or z error, because that's all we really know how to do. So error correction is we add an ancilla. And then we, you know, do some gates. I don't have a good name for it, but unitaries. And so what we're doing is we're doing this stage of the circuit. But I want to stop before the measurements. Okay. So the point is the ancilla should now, in the case of where it really was an x or z error, would have in this register an error syndrome that corresponds to that particular poly error. So in particular, if we started with the state I psi, well, that would be a code word without any errors. So the ancilla should say there's no error. It'll have the error syndrome all zeros, for instance. And if we had zj psi, well, the ancilla should now say that there's the error is zj. It'll be whatever error syndrome corresponds to that. Okay. Now, what we actually have is superposition of these two things. But quantum mechanics is linear, so if this happens to this state and this happens to this state, then the superposition has to go to the same superposition. So what we have is cosine theta times this minus I sine theta times that. Okay? And so now the next step in our correction is we measure the ancilla. So what happens here? So we have this state, we measure the ancilla. Well, this error syndrome and this error syndrome are different, right? They're orthogonal states. So when we measure, we're going to get one of these two results. So either we're going to get no error, the error syndrome that says no error, and that happens with probability cosine squared theta. And when that happens, we're left with the residual state I psi. Okay? Or we're going to have the error syndrome that says the error was zj, and that happens with probability sine squared theta. And in that case, this is the residual state, zj psi. Okay? So with one probability, we'll get one error syndrome, one probability, we'll get another error syndrome. That's unsurprising. The thing that's interesting and exciting is that if we happen to get the error syndrome that says there's no error, then the state is actually one that has no error. And if we get the error syndrome that says there was an error zj, the state that we have left over is one that actually has an error zj. So this is really a triumph of wishful thinking. By pretending it was actually an x, y, or z error, and going through this procedure, we made that actually be the case. It started out as this continuous rotation, but now it is just an I or a z error. Okay? So that means that this R2 theta error is something that we can correct without doing anything different. We don't even have to think about it as a possibility, right? By just correcting as if it were an I, X, Y, or Z error, we're also correcting this R2 theta error. And if you follow through that logic, so does front board work now? Let's find out. Nope. Okay. Okay. So if you follow through that logic, you can see that it wasn't really dependent on that particular linear combination we had, right? If we had any linear combination of Pauli errors, it would have worked the same way. Or really any other combination of errors that we corrected. So we have a general statement about quantum error correcting codes. If a quantum error correcting code corrects errors A and B, then it also corrects alpha A plus beta B. Okay? Just using the same logic that I gave before. And in particular, suppose it corrects all the Pauli errors, I, X, Y, and Z. Well, if we have any 2x2 matrix, you can write that as a superposition of I, X, Y, and Z. Right? They form a basis for the space of 2x2 matrices. So if it corrects I, X, Y, Z on single qubits, then it corrects any linear operation on single qubits. And actually, this generalizes to t qubits as well. If you look at the space of t qubit, if you look at a 2 to the t by 2 to the t matrix, It can be the basis, or a basis, is tensor products of x, y, and z of on up to t qubits, I, x, y, and z on t qubits. So this would also be true if we correct qualities on t qubits, and then we can correct t qubit errors. So this at least should handle immediately handle the continuous rotations. Let me say a word or two about decoherence as well. So if we have a completely positive map, completely positive trace-preserving map, we have rho going to ak rho ak dagger, right? And so rho, if it's a pure state, it's psi psi. And so this is ak psi and then psi ak dagger. So you can think of this as with some probability, we're having ak occurring on the state, where ak doesn't have to be unitary, but it does have to be linear, right? And this statement here didn't really care whether it was unitary or not, right? It corrects any linear operation, because you can always write any linear operation as a sum of I, X, Y, and Z. And so we can, if we can correct all of the Krauss operators in a CP map, then we can correct the whole CP map. And in particular, if we correct arbitrary single qubit linear operations, well, if we have a single qubit CP map, obviously these are going to be single qubit linear operations, so we can correct them. Okay? So the upshot is that when I say this, I really mean we can correct any quantum operation, whether it's a coherent thing or an incoherent thing, so long as it's just affecting a single qubit. So that handles this fourth problem. And so the 9-qubit code, therefore, is a true quantum error correcting code. Not only does it encode qubits and protect superpositions, but it protects them against arbitrary single qubit errors. OK? So are there any questions on that? Okay, so let me mention one other thing. So at the beginning, I was talking about this kind of classical model where we say there's some probability of error occurring per qubit. But in quantum mechanics, we might want to think about more general cases that can't really be described that way. And so the notion that there's just one qubit that's going wrong might be flawed. But it is the case that we want to talk about things where the error somehow is small on each qubit. So in the classical case, that was because the probability of error was small. In the quantum case, it might be something like, well, each qubit gets rotated a little bit, but it's only by a small amount. Okay. So we might have something that looks, for instance, like this. So U epsilon is some small unitary rotation, and it's occurring on every qubit. And so it turns out we can correct stuff like this as well. Why? Well, we can expand this. So if U epsilon here is the identity plus epsilon U prime, then U epsilon tensor N, we expand it in a Taylor series, we're going to get the identity, of course, as the leading order thing, plus epsilon times u prime on the first qubit, u prime on the second qubit, plus dot, dot, dot. And then we're going to get, well, we're going to get some order epsilon squared terms, which I won't write down, which involve, you know, u prime on 2 qubits or 3 qubits or 4 qubits. And so if epsilon is small, we can kind of ignore this order epsilon squared term. And we know that the quantum error correcting code it corrects single qubit errors, right? And so these things here are all single qubit errors. And so since by this theorem, if the code corrects each one of them, it corrects the sum of them. And it can also correct the sum of epsilon times that plus the identity, since it corrects the identity. So anything up to here will get corrected by the quantum error correcting code. The stuff that's left over might not get corrected. But that's order epsilon squared in size. So you see, again, you get the same kind of improvement. Whereas before, we were improving from the probability of error p to probability of error order p squared. Now we're improving from, you know, fidelity, infidelity of epsilon to infidelity of epsilon squared. Right? Okay? And again, it's the same error correcting code. We don't need to change how we're dealing with things. Okay? Okay. Let's cut this space. Oh, but that blackboard works. Okay. So I don't need to be too careful about space. So for the remainder of today and tomorrow, we're going to be, obviously it's already come up that the Pauli errors x, y, and z are playing an important role. But they're going to be even more important for the rest of today and for tomorrow. So I want to define this thing called the Pauli group. So you have x, y, and z. I've written down for you before. Maybe I should do it again. So y is here. X, of course, is this. And z is this. The Pauli group is, did I want to, yeah. So I'm going to write it as a script P. And this is the Pauli group on n qubits. And so it's consisting of tensor products of I, x, y, and z on n qubits. But I want it to be a group, so I want it to be closed under multiplication. And if you multiply x times z, well, you don't get y, you get minus I y. So we need some phases here as well. And in order to close it as a group, we just need the phase plus or minus 1 or plus or minus I. Okay? And so that's a group. And it's a group with a lot of nice properties. So some of the properties that I'll be using a lot are, well, first of all, any element squares to either plus 1 or minus 1, plus identity or minus identity, right? So x, y, and z, if you write them out, they all square to the identity. But of course, ix will square to minus the identity. And if you have a tensor product like x tensor y tensor I, well, that will also square to the identity, whereas I times that would square to minus the identity. And so the other property that I'll be using is that any two elements either commute or they anti-commute. Now, obviously, again, for the single qubit Pauli group, x, y, and z all anti-commute with each other and commute with themselves. They also commute with the identity. But once you have two qubit Pauli group, then you have some more interesting cases of commutation. So for instance, x tensor x commutes with Z tensor Z. Right, because you move each x past each z, you get a minus 1. But 2 minus 1s give you a plus 1. Okay? Yeah, and so maybe at this point it's also worth defining the weight of something. It's not directly connected to the Pauli group, but mostly I'll be using it in reference to the Pauli group. So the weight of something in the Pauli group is the number of qubits which is not the identity. Right? So if you have x tensor I tensor x, that's something that's weight 2. Okay? Okay, so the next thing I'd like to do is to look at this 9-qubit code and think a little bit more carefully about what it means to measure the error syndrome for it. Okay, so maybe putting it up is a little premature. So remember that to correct bit flip errors, we want to look within each set of 3 and say, are the first 2 qubits the same or different? And are the second and third qubits the same or different? So that's putting it in kind of classical language. And to be even more classical computer science-y, you could say it's the parity of the first 2 bits, even or odd. But let's put it in a more quantum language. Okay? And in quantum language, we might say, is this a plus 1 or minus 1 eigenvalue of something? Of what, specifically? Well, if we look at Z tensor Z, right, Z tensor Z has plus 1 eigenvalue if you have 0, 0, or 1, 1, right, if they're the same in the Z basis. And it has minus 1 eigenvalue if they're different, 0, 1, or 1, 0. So saying if the 2 qubits are the same or different, it's the same as measuring the eigenvalue. Sorry, a little bit more. Measuring the eigenvalue of Z tensor Z. Okay? So saying with each set of 3, are these the same or different, gives us a whole bunch of pairs of qubits, and in particular, a whole bunch of operators, Z tensor Z, where we're measuring the eigenvalue. 6 of them, to be precise. So now we have these things that we're measuring the eigenvalue for to determine the bit flip errors. And to measure the phase errors, we want to say, are the phases the same or different? Okay, again, let's try to think of that as eigenvalues of some operators. Well, in order to distinguish between 000 plus 111 and 000 minus 111, we're going to have to access the phase somehow. And suppose we do a bit flip. Well, changing 10 to 11 is not going to help. But if we change all 3, if we do XXX, that will switch 000 and 000 plus 111 with 000. Sorry. That will switch 000 and 111. And if we have plus, we'll get an eigenvalue of plus 1. Because 000 minus 111, we'll get an eigenvalue of minus 1. OK? But we don't want that, because we don't want to measure the actual phase on one set of 3. We want to see if they're the same or different between 2 sets of 3. So what we have to do is we have to take 6 x's. Okay, and if we do this, that will tell us if the phases on the first set of 3 and the second set of 3 are the same or different, right? If they're plus plus or minus minus, we get an eigenvalue plus 1. And if they're plus minus or minus plus, we'll get an eigenvalue minus 1. Okay? And similarly, the 6 x's from qubits 4 through 9 will tell us where the second and third phases are the same or different. Okay? And so this gives us eight operators whose eigenvalues tell us the error syncrome of the code. But notice that, you know, this was not really the only way we could have done it. So for instance, within one set of three, instead of saying, are the first two the same or different, or the second and third the same or different, we could have said, are the first and third the same or different? Substituting, say, the first and second for the first and third. That would have worked us as well, right? And that's kind of captured here too, right? Because if we take the product of this and this, what do we get? We get ZIZ, which is saying that the first and third should have a plus one eigenvalue for the right code word and a minus one eigenvalue if there's been an error on one of those two qubits. Okay? And indeed, if the correct code words have plus one eigenvalues for all of these things, then if you take any product of these, it's still going to have a plus one eigenvalue. So more generally, what we could do is we could say, let's define some group as follows. It's going to be the set of M such that M is in the Pauli group. And M psi equals psi for all psi in the code. OK, in this case, the 9-qubit code, but it's In a minute, we're going to generalize it. Or actually, let's let that minute be now. So now we're going to do this for an arbitrary quantum error correct encode. We've defined, you know, the encoding of 0 and 1, or however many qubits we want to encode. And we can define this stabilizer. Now, it turns out that for arbitrary quantum error correct encodes, it's not necessarily an interesting thing to look at. But there's a big class of codes where it is. And so for one of those codes, we can define the stabilizer. And you see, for the 9-qubit code, these then become generators of the stabilizer. Right? So the stabilizer consists exactly of the products of these eight operators. And so the stabilizer has the following properties. So first of all, so it consists of polys, but it doesn't consist of arbitrary polys, right? Because one of the things that's in the Pauli group is minus the identity. And this thing has to have eigenvalue plus 1 for the code words. So it does not, the stabilizer can never contain minus the identity, right? And that also means it can't contain, say, x tensor x with phase I. Because that would square to minus the identity, and this is a group. OK, but I guess I could show that it's a group. Well, that's pretty straightforward, right? So if m and n are in the stabilizer, then that means that mn psi, well, psi is in the stabilizer, so n psi is equal to psi. This is equal to m psi. And m is in the stabilizer, so m psi is equal to psi as well. So mn psi is equal to psi, and mn has this property for all psi in the code. But moreover, it's actually an abelian group. So why is that? Well, so abelian group means that everything in it commutes. So suppose, again, we have mn in the stabilizer. Well, we know that mn psi is equal to psi. And that same argument tells us that nm psi is equal to psi. So if we look at the commutator of m and n applied to psi, They both give us psi, so this gives us 0. Oh, let's put it up here.
What about for states that aren't a part of the code?
Well, so we're not making any constraint here on states that aren't a part of the code. So we don't know offhand whether this commutator, so the commutator has to annihilate code words. But we don't know right immediately what it does to non-code words. However, remember, M and N are in the poly group. So either they commute or they anti-commute. Now, if they commute, that's what we're trying to show. If they anti-commute, then that means that the commutator of them, well, if you work it out for polys, you're going to see it's you know, 2 times another poly. And the polys don't have any 0 eigenvalues. So if they anti-commuted, this would not be possible. So since polys commute or anti-commute, we can rule out that second possibility, and therefore M and N commute. Okay? So that's saying it's actually an abelian group. Okay, so so maybe I should stop there for the day, and then tomorrow we'll be continuing to talk about the stabilizer codes and how it's a useful approach to these things. I'll discuss that more tomorrow. But we have like a minute or two if there's any questions.
So you want to know more about this? Should we watch your lectures on Pure Sound?
Well, the first thing you should do is you should come to class tomorrow. That's the easiest thing to do.
Of course.
Then it depends how much you want to know. If you want to know a whole lot, yes, I have full semester courses recorded on this. On my webpage, there's a list of resources on quantum error correction to kind of give you reading that's of varying lengths, depending on how much you want to know. You can also ask questions if it's not too much. Anything else? Okay, then see you tomorrow.